Category E6, speech broadcaster, Tom Dunn.
Would you believe that one in five pregnancies in Ireland actually end in a miscarriage? And I heard yesterday, I don't see this one in print in front of me, but I believe it is true, that one in four of first-time pregnancies ends in a miscarriage. There are 14,000 a year, 50 a day, that is. It affects everybody. But the big thing about it is it's very rarely discussed until you have one. Now, I have to admit that we actually had two, and I didn't think anyone at all had them until we raised our hand. And then suddenly it seemed everybody was raising their hands and saying, happened to me. Siobhan O'Neill had a miscarriage a number of years ago and found it very tough. And the story, it is quite amazing. And I think that's why we have you here today, Siobhan. What happens next in the case of miscarriage can often leave a lot to be desired, can't it?
It can. Good morning. It's very difficult. I think it can damage a relationship. Sometimes it can be a make or break thing in a relationship because it's a huge trauma. You know, people would say, well, if it was early on in your pregnancy, you were only a little bit pregnant. And I know a lovely friend of mine, June, would say, you're never only a little bit pregnant, you're pregnant. So once you get two blue lines or two pink dots or whatever it is, when you pee on that stick, your life has changed forever. And you see a different future for yourself. And whether it was an expected pregnancy or an unexpected pregnancy, wherever it comes, whichever way it comes to you, your life does change instantly in that moment. And You know, your brain starts to go in different directions and you're planning a future and you're thinking different ways. And then when you lose that baby, you can't just switch back to the way your life was before you were pregnant. It's very difficult. And it's a very difficult thing to deal with because when you lose a pregnancy, it's not tangible. So you don't have, unless it's later on in the pregnancy, you don't particularly have like a funeral. And other people didn't know that baby. And it's people don't know how to react to you. They don't know how to grieve, if they should grieve, if they should say something.
It's that vision of your future, isn't it? You just,
Christmas.
For 12 weeks or whatever, you're thinking about how things are going to be different.
I always would think about Christmas and I'd look ahead and think there'd be another little person looking at the lights twinkling on the Christmas tree. And then when Christmas comes and that little person's not there, very, very difficult to deal with that.
It is. And it's funny, but it isn't really discussed. It's not very discussed.
No, and I think it is something that needs to be talked about more. And I mean, I make an effort to talk about it. And I don't go around talking about it all the time, obviously. But we wrote the book. My husband and I wrote it together. And it stemmed from a diary that I was keeping because I was so upset after our first miscarriage. And my husband and I weren't communicating very well. And we just didn't know how to communicate. And there wasn't really any services offered to us at the hospital to help us with dealing with this loss. And we kind of drifted a little bit apart from each other. And somebody recommended I should actually keep a diary. And I would really highly recommend that to any mums that are out there. Write it down. And you can write it down privately or you can write it down and share it with somebody. It's entirely your decision, but it's a very powerful thing to write down with pen and paper how you're feeling. You'd be surprised after 5 minutes, things will start pouring out of you that you never expected. And I wrote this story.
The thing that comes across in your story is a lack of empathy. Pretty much at every time. And we experienced that as well. One or two things that were said will live with me forever. And we just had to carry on. You know, we were determined to have a family. But I think back that the professionals involved are dealing with this on a daily basis. And for them not to be a little bit more emphatic with people coming in.
Doctors and nurses, they have a very difficult job. We all acknowledge that. And the situation right now with the hospitals is very bad and they're really under pressure and we can appreciate that. However, you're talking about somebody's baby, somebody's child, somebody's life, future, family. And when they lose that baby, and the same for ourselves, Tom, we were told by a doctor, it's probably a miscarriage, hasn't happened yet. And he walked out of the room and he didn't even look us in the eye when he delivered that news to us. And I think we were equally shocked at, first of all, the news that we were going to lose this baby, and the way it was delivered, it was unbelievable to us that a doctor could deliver information like that.
You were 12 weeks gone,
12 weeks.
Still very early days.
Yeah, but you know, there was a heartbeat there, but the baby was very small. So we did actually see that little baby's heartbeat and it was there on the screen. And I remember that, and that's a nice memory to have. And then sadly, that baby, I went into labour. And this was shocking
into
to me.
Labor.
I didn't know you could go into labour at 12 and a half weeks pregnant. Nobody told me this. The doctors and nurses hadn't alerted me to the fact that I would bleed and have a lot of pain. So when I went home, and I already had a child at home, he was coming up to being a year old, it was like my waters broke and I went into labour. And my mother was actually in the house and I was again, I was in absolute shock because nobody had told me, and this is what you're saying about the professionals, somebody should have just sat with me for 30 seconds and said, listen, when you go home over the next few days, this could happen. Yeah. This may happen. If this happens, here's what you need to do. So I went into the hospital and I was having full-on contractions. I couldn't believe it. And I was brought into the emergency room because...
And you knew that. You'd had a child already, so you knew this.
I knew it wasn't good.
This was a contraction.
And there was a lot of blood. And I knew it was a contraction. And the worst thing for us was they made my husband sit in the reception area.
And this I find amazing.
Yeah, they would not let him in. I couldn't fathom it. I've never begged in my life until that day. And I begged. I actually begged the nurse, please, I begged her, let my husband in. I said, I can't actually do this on my own. I can't deal with contractions and losing my baby on my own. And she said, it's hospital policy, he's not coming in. And I was in an emergency room surrounded by women who were going into labour at full term, and there was heartbeats all around me.
That's very harsh.
And I remember thinking, you know, when you have a baby, it's such a happy, special day. I didn't want those women to know I was losing a baby. So I was trying not to cry because I didn't want to upset them.
Oh no, you'd worry them.
So I was literally covering my mouth so that I wasn't ruining their special day. Now, in hindsight, I shouldn't have been put in that position, and my husband should have been with me because I would have been much calmer if he'd been with me. And then the other side of that is he was outside with his head in his hands imagining the worst possible scenario, and he asked for some updates. Nobody gave him an update. I was in there for 3 hours and eventually the baby was gone. They put me into a wheelchair. I heard a woman, a nurse on the phone say, have a lady here, complete miscarriage, taking her upstairs. And I actually thought, is she talking about me? Does that mean it's over? And I said to her, sorry, were you talking about me there? Does that mean that my miscarriage, it's over now? That's it, we're taking you upstairs. And I said, okay. And they wheeled me out and my husband ran over and he said, well, and they hadn't told him. So I had to tell him. Now it was just the series of unfortunate things that happened made it much more traumatic.
That is music from a band that I would always describe as Derry's finest, The Undertones. And I believe if you're a fan of that band and you have the first album where they're photographed in the park is just beside where Martin McGuinness lived. Is this correct, Martin?
It is indeed. I live in Westland Terrace, and if you walk to the end of my street, you're at the ballpark where that photograph was taken.
Very good. That was 1978 or 77. Yeah. Were you even aware, would you have been aware of them at that time, or were you talking?
Well, I mean, they were obviously one of the biggest bands in the country at that stage. Yeah. So once they had the hit, they were world news, and we were very, very proud of their achievements. And
I'm delighted to know that. I often wonder if that kind of stuff managed to impinge at all on the world that you were in. Because you were in such a difficult world.
Yeah, at the time, Derry was in a conflict situation, occupied by thousands of British soldiers. But lighter moments were obviously appreciated by the local people, and a great sense of pride in the achievements of young guys from in and around the Bogside who were able to go to the top of the hit parade.
They were the best of the bands, man.
Yeah,
they were the best.
Well, was it John Peel that said that record was the best record ever made?
Absolutely, and he pulled over to the side of the road and cried the first time that he heard it playing. Isn't that a great response?
Fantastic,
great. Just, I want to try and get a sense of you, and I was reading a fair bit about you, and it seems to me that I have a photograph of your entire family here, just to bring you back there. Which one of them is the first one? Your first child, Grainne, wasn't
it? Grainne, she's the eldest, and she's married and living in County Donegal, here.
Very nice.
And she has two boys, Tiernan and Oisin.
When she was born, were you able to go to the birth? Were you?
Well, when she was born in 1975. Yeah. And that was just after the internment had been done away with by the Labour government.
Yeah.
So I was able to move around, although I was still subject to consistent arrest by the RUC and brought to all sorts of interrogation centres. But yes, I was there when she was born.
Special moment?
A fantastic moment. The most special moment in your life.
Absolutely.
Has to be when your children are born.
Yeah. Second child comes along. Second child was Fionnuala. When was that?
Fionnuala was born in 1976 in December.
Okay.
On Lundy's Day, as they call it, in Derry, the 18th of December. And we actually thought Fionnuala was a boy because whenever they were wrapping her up in the blanket, they put a blue blanket on her. We thought they made a mistake. But no, Fionnuala's great. And Fionnuala has two lovely children, Kiana and Rossa.
And then your two boys come along, Fiacra and Emmett.
Fiacra is married and he has a daughter, Ciara.
Yeah.
And they live in the Pennyburn area. And they're all great kids. We never had
what
one minute's
like,
trouble with anyone.
What family life did you have? Because, I mean, apart from the fact that you were being arrested, your life would have been under threat as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, our home was constantly raided by the British Army and by the RUC for many years. And they used to have this technique of taking you away to Castlereagh Interrogation Centre, where they would keep you for a week. And on most occasions, they wouldn't even ask you any questions. You'd just be sitting there. And that was by, you know, I suppose, at the start, they tried ill treatment of me. The first time ever I was arrested was brought to Strand Road, RUC station, and, in fact, was interrogated by two junior detectives who then rose to become very senior figures in the RUC. One of them actually reached the position of assistant chief constable. But this particular guy, and I won't mention his name, I was sitting on a chair. We had a table, and the other guy was sitting the other side of the table, and every time he would come round the back of my head, he would clench his fist and he would hit the back of my head with his knuckles. So after 2 or 3 minutes, I said to myself, if this goes on, this guy could kill me, you know. So the next time he came round, I just stood up and grabbed him by the lapels, ran him over the table on top of the other guy, and the three of us ended up in the corner, and then all the top notches came in.
Right.
And after that, they decided that ill treatment wasn't going to work with me, so they just used to disrupt family life completely, bring you to the interrogation centre.
Now,
keep you from
that I would imagine would get to you even worse, because it's one thing thinking I'm a strong man and if they hit me, I'll hit them back. But when they, if your family were involved, if they're raiding, if they're making your family's life and your kids' life, that must get to you.
Yeah, it was very, very difficult. And my children, you know, were now very normal and well-adjusted family people themselves. Mm-hmm. But I remember one occasion the British Army raiding the house, and Emmett, who's the youngest, was standing at the head of the stairs, and he was 3 years old at the time, and he was so frightened at the soldiers coming up the stairs, I could actually see him urinating.
Oh, God. How did you cope with that?
Through his pyjama. It was very, very difficult indeed. And I think people don't really appreciate what people in the north went through.
I don't think we do.
During those times.
Would Bernie have ever said to you, Martin, this is mad?
Bernie has been fantastic. Bernie is the most wonderful person that you could ever hope to meet. Mm. She is just a really, really solid person, and obviously I love her dearly. We've been very close all of our lives.
But she never say to you, this is no family life, this is no life for children.
No, Bernie's a Republican. Bernie's like me. She wants to see a free and independent Ireland. She wants to see a 32-county republic. We were standing up for ourselves against all of the injustices and inequalities and discriminations that were being foisted upon the people that we lived among. And, I mean, Derry is as Irish as Dublin. You know, the community we come from regards itself as Irish, and it's been very difficult.
We got a lovely email in from a lady called Anne Bennett. She said, dearest darling Tom, settle down, I'm in my 70s. Mind you, I'm not a bad looking 70 in a good light. I need your help. I have over 300 vinyl LPs, all in pretty good condition, that need a good home. It's a collection of over 50 years that my husband and I and my son have put together. It consists of rock from the 60s and the 70s, big bands, mainly American, bought in New York by my retired Aer Lingus pilot husband, and also film themes, light and classical compilations. Can you help? I just can't take them to the local recycling centre. Surely someone might like to help us with these or take them off our hands. It's all free. I live near enough to County Cork and will deliver them to your Opera Lane studios if that would help. Yours, Anne. Well, good news. Anne joins us now on the phone to tell us more. Anne, good morning. How are you today?
Good morning, Tom.
Lovely to talk to you, Anne.
Nice to talk to you too.
Well, dearest darling Tom. It's not often somebody refers to me as dearest darling Tom in an email, I'll tell you.
Yeah, well, I had to get your attention.
You certainly did.
Yeah, well, I mean, it works every time.
It did, absolutely.
You guys are so easy.
Really?
Oh, yes.
We can push our buttons in a heartbeat.
Absolutely. You never change. I'm in my 70s and you still haven't changed.
Really? And you've been playing us for fools for all your life.
Oh, well, no, not really for fools, really. But making sure that we get your attention.
Certainly works. So tell me, sounds like an absolutely beautiful record collection you have.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, we downsized. If you ever hear of anyone talking about downsizing, just say the word don't.
Really?
Because you'll end up in a smaller house with masses of stuff, and I ended up with these LPs I just couldn't throw away because, you know, it brings back memories and stuff. And my son's rock collection, he's not with us anymore, sadly. He was killed on his motorbike
Sorry to hear
in
that.
The 80s. But I kept all his records because of sentimentally.
Right.
And I've got all these rock records. I don't even know the names of these people. Yes, and Rush, and ELO,
really?
And, you know.
He was into prog rock.
Oh, very. Is that what you call it?
Prog rock, yeah.
What's prog rock?
Ah, solos that go on for days and bizarre piano pieces that nobody can understand and a very high level of musicianship.
He had Yes. Is that
Yes.
Rush was his favourite.
Yeah. Rush, they're kind of more metal.
Tangerine Dream. No, I quite liked Tangerine Dream.
All right.
Because I liked the sounds that it made.
Right. He was a man of particular tastes.
Oh, he was.
Yeah.
He was. And he had collected a lot. Sex Pistols.
Aha.
Who's Sammy Hagar?
Sammy Hagar.
Hagar, sorry.
Yeah, he's a bit of
a
legend.
Look, most of the, they don't even give the name on the cover. You have to take the record out and have a look at the thing in the middle.
Yes.
You know, to find the name.
Yeah.
Mudrock. Joy Division. I'm just reading out a few of the names.
Go on, keep going.
Mighty Diamonds.
Yeah.
Ian Dury and the Blockheads.
Yes, please.
Oh, yeah, you can have, yes, you're welcome.
Ian Dury and the Blockheads, one of the legends. This is punk rock stuff now he's gone through, 1978.
Oh, yeah, and Genesis, yeah. Nick Gilder, Michael Jackson and stuff.
He'd very broad palette of tastes.
Very broad palette. The Sweets.
Lovely, yeah. Glam rock band from the 70s.
What do I do with them? That's what
I don't know. I can't believe you want to get rid of them.
Yeah, come on. That's not my style.
There are many things that concern me about this. One, that you're giving away this huge chunk of your life.
Yeah, but look, no, Tom. It's like puppies. I want to give them to a good home. Do you know, somebody who'll say, oh, wow, that's great, you know?
What about the value? Would you not like to make a bit of money on them?
If anyone wants to give me something, I want a donation to my favourite charity.
All right, so you're very clear you don't want money out of this.
No, I don't.
All right. We're inundated with people saying they'd love to take your records and give them to a good home. I'll give Anne's vinyl collection a very good home and keep her son's memory alive by playing his Joy Division and his rock LPs. I love vinyls.
Good, that's what I like. That's exactly what I want to hear.
That'll be my feeling anyway. Let's have a word with Mark and Dylan. Mark, good morning. How are you today?
Hello, Tom Dolan. How's it going?
Very well. Do you like the sound of that record collection?
Yeah, it sounds amazing.
So are you going to make a bid?
I am. I'm going to start it off. I'd put up 200 quid easy. I'm sure if I got more, a couple of my friends, we'd put 100 in each.
You're going to make an offer of 200 euro here and now.
Get the ball rolling. Hopefully we get more money.
All right. For those of you joining in, it's a 300 record collection. They span from the 50s all the way through to the
90s. 300, you'd even go more. I'll go 350.
He's going 350.
350.
God. Maybe I should do this auction thing more often. I'm after getting you from 200 to 350 without really trying. That's incredible. 300 albums. What's your bid going to be, Porrick?
I'd like to offer 600 euro, Tom.
600 euro?
Yeah.
I can't get over how quickly it's gone up. So what offer are you going to make, Bridge?
I'm going to make an offer of 1,000.
1,000? It's going. I'm getting good at this auctioneering thing.
I'll tell you.
For the Tanya McCabe Fund, Zan. And please tell Mary from one of her Lycra gang, I think she's a hero. I always think the puffers at the back are the ones we should salute. Philippa, who's an ultra marathon runner.
Oh God! There was a lot of your, you know, encouraging me, and I was going with Gisha. The other thing, just at the very end, which I noticed, as you got to the sort of end of the field, the arse has got bigger.
Really?
Yes.
Sounds like there's a bit of research you could do there, Mary.
So I was last.
God,
what does that tell you?
Size of arse. Position in fields.
Right. Well, you're dragging all that weight around with you, you know.
I have to do this now. Dr. Bill, he hasn't gone away.
Oh.
Put your headphones on now. Get ready.
Dr. Bill's essential inner city guide. Today's word is gammy, as in stalled bald air. Who told you that? It was Peter with the gammy eye told me. Ah, no, his brother Mary, with the gammy leg and high-pitched voice. Bit light in the plimsoll, so to speak. The word gammy came into the Irish vernacular in 1754, when Edward de Gammy arrived in the Liberties in a little boat from France. The Gammies were famous in France for inventing runny cheese, so they were, and came to the Liberties to avoid the cold steel on the Gregory Peck. But Edward de Gammy was afflicted. He had a gammy eye, a gammy arm and a gammy leg, and left to his own devices, would unknowingly walk in ever-decreasing circles. The gammy eye went badly against him, As peering over his shoulder, he became increasingly convinced he was being followed by another man with a gammy eye and a gammy arm and a gammy leg. The gammy eye only got worse, and the man behind him seemed to close in on him faster and faster. Jamais, jamais, gammy! He was heard to cry that morning when the gamminess got too much for him, and to escape the man following him, he jumped into the Liffey. They say he swam in the circle. They say he swam in circles for days. And the phrase, can you swim? No, I'm gammy at it, soon passed into common usage. Gammy today is used to describe Alton that's not quite up to the mark, like Mary's gammy run in Nice. More anon.
News Talk 106 to 108.